Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hello, 2009, week one after the holidays, and it's game on all over. President-elect Barack Obama took the podium to call for speed on economic stimulus.
It is altogether likely that things may get worse before they get better. But that is all the more reason for Congress to act without delay.
Blagojevich, Senate pick from Illinois, Roland Burris, turned away for a while on Capitol Hill, told go.
My credentials were not in order, and I would not be accepted, nor will I be seated, nor will I be permitted on the floor.
And Israeli mortar fire blasted a UN school as fighting raged in Gaza. Here's John Ging of the UN.
Nowhere is safe. We have the tragedy of the deaths last night in one of our schools where people had come fleeing the conflict, hoping for safety, and now they're dead.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining me now from Washington is David Ignatius, associate editor and columnist at the Washington Post, and co-moderator with Fareed Zakaria of the Post Global blog. He's big on foreign policy and intelligence, also author of six novels. His latest, The Increment, is coming out in May. David Ignatius, thanks for being here. Happy New Year.
Hi, Tom. Happy New Year to you.
And from Washington, we're joined by Margaret Tolove, now White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Margaret Tolove, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thanks, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Margaret.
Let's go straight to the economy. Margaret, is Barack Obama running into problems on getting through the stimulus that he is so loudly asking for this week? And if he is, why? Is it the shape of it? Is it something else? What's going on with this push?
Yes, yes, and yes. It is the size of it, it is the shape of it, and it is just the sheer magnitude of what he has to tackle, and it's the fact that there are already problems with the way the bailout money's been spent and a lot of skepticism on Capitol Hill. He's facing infighting from Democrats. He's facing resistance from Republicans. He'll get it done, but it won't be on the timeline that they wanted it done, and it may not be exactly how he wants it.
Here's the argument that's being made for it. This here by Robert Reich, testifying Wednesday before the House Democratic and Policy Steering Committee. Former Labor Secretary Clinton administration said the government must take action to curb economic woes.
We've got ourselves into a vicious cycle. And that vicious cycle is that because consumers don't have the money, then businesses are not going to produce. And if businesses don't produce, they're going to lay people off. And if they lay people off, people have even less money. And that vicious cycle can only be remedied, it can only be turned around by concerted government action. Government is the spender of last resort.
And of course, Obama himself speaking yesterday at George Mason University with a very similar message, stressing the importance of acting urgently to address the economic crisis, warning of dire consequences if action is delayed.
But I urge Congress to move as quickly as possible on behalf of the American people. For every day we wait or point fingers or drag our feet, more Americans will lose their jobs. More families will lose their savings. More dreams will be deferred and denied. And our nation will sink deeper into a crisis that at some point we may not be able to reverse.
Holy smokes, that's dire. David Ignatius, what's your reading here? Do you think Obama is really worried that he may not get what he's pushing for here, that he's bitten off more than he can chew, or is he just trying to build the biggest head of steam he can before he takes that oath of office?
I think he's genuinely worried about the situation with the economy. I'm told that this issue is preoccupying him and his inner circle in these days in the run-up to the inauguration to the exclusion of many other issues. They just think all the time about domestic economic problems. I thought the language in his speech yesterday was unusually sharp, even if you assume that part of what he was doing was lowering expectations to talk about double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment, to talk about,
yeah,
about a lost generation of workers. That's heavy language. I think that he has decided that the key here is to move as quickly as possible with this $770 billion roughly stimulus package that they're talking about to get that enacted soon, despite the kind of skepticism that Margaret was talking about a moment ago. So they're adding additional features like the tax cuts to try to get Republican support, bipartisan support. The problem is that as they add each new element to this, I think it becomes unwieldy, somewhat incoherent. Their view is that the details matter less than the speed with which it's done. But I think you'd make a mistake in not seeing genuine concern on the part of the president-elect and his advisors.
Jack Beatty, concerned about the size of this and what it means for a deficit that we're already told this week will hit $1.2 trillion this year without it, on the other hand. From the sort of progressive side of the spectrum, you've got Paul Krugman saying today, Obama's economic plan is not as strong as his language. In fact, it falls well short, Krugman says, of what's needed. Not enough.
Yeah, he points out that we're expected to have $2.1 trillion in lost production over the next year, and this over the next 2 years, and this is a $775 billion plan. That's not enough to make up for that. You know, John Judas points out today in the New Republic that in 1936, unemployment was 6.9%. In 1942, it was 4.2%. Why? Massive, sustained government spending. And what could we do if we were to really see this in its full dimension and the kind of crisis? In other words, if the gap between Obama's rhetoric and the policy prescriptions were to be filled, what sort of things could we spend money on? Well, he points to things like a high-speed rail in the Northeast Corridor, $32 billion. High-speed rail in California, $40 billion. That kind of massive, years-long endeavor could help. The real problem, I think, here is, one, Obama is neuralgic about a $1 trillion stimulus. He just, the figure is frightening, and politically it's charged. And two, he seems to think he can get 70 to 80 votes in the Senate. And to do that, he is putting in some of these tax cuts. One tax policy center person says the business tax cuts are big buck, little bang, and already the Democrats are complaining about that. So, you know, if he weakens the overall stimulus in order to get Republican votes for it, I don't see that that the country comes out ahead.
Margaret Taleb, how do you interpret that? Is Obama so determined to have some Republican votes in there that he's willing to weaken, Jack's word, the plan? Why are those votes so important to him? If speed is number one here, he could pass it through with just a few Republicans. Why not do that?
Well, he did campaign saying, I'm going to be different than everyone else, and I know you're cynical, but seriously, this time I really am going to be different than everyone else. And so far, you know, there's not much of a track record one way or the other because he hasn't even started yet. So if he's going to come out of the gate with something that is going to be at a minimum $775 billion and probably more like $850 or upward, he wants some long-term sustained Republican support for what he's doing so that it's not just jamming it through, but what happens afterward. Also, what he's selling and what, to some extent, what Republicans are accepting is the idea that only government can fix these problems. And it's so anathema to sort of the guiding principle of what the Republican leadership had been about over the last decade or longer, if you're going to sell that idea, you have to have Republicans on board.
And yet, of course, Wall Street's been wide open to its $700 billion, and there's a lot of business tax cutting in here as well as straight-up government making up business losses. Let's get a call from Richmond, Vermont, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out that if we inject around $1 trillion in the economy this year, another trillion next year probably, maybe even another after that, we're going to have a massive inflation in three or four years, which is a terrible tax. And I'm just going to go offline and this is you on the radio. Thank
John,
you.
We've got it. Thank you. David Ignatius, maybe traditionally inflation baked into this, but deflation is still front and center in a lot of commentary that I'm reading. I mean, which is it, or both? Or we just don't know while we're in the crisis?
Well, I think the reason that the broad consensus of economists is supporting this very, very heavy spending, deficit spending, as part of a recovery program is that in the near term, the danger is deflation. It's prices going down, not prices going up. Over the long run, you cannot run the kind of deficits we're talking about, expanding them into the trillions of dollars in new spending without paying for it in one of two ways. Either you raise taxes, which is an enormous tax burden on the future, or you inflate your way out of it. You, in effect, monetize the debt, and the value of our currency declines. So there are two unappetizing ways over the longer term that this is going to get paid for. I think economists know that, and I don't think the public as a whole understands that yet, but they just don't see a way out. The problem here is compounded by the fact that finally, after years of, you could argue, profligate spending, dissaving, people spending much more than they earn, the country as a whole consuming more than it was producing, we've slammed on the brakes and people are now beginning to save, which means that every additional dollar they get through a government program, they're going to save more of that, which means the effect of these programs in stimulating the economy is less than you'd like, the multiplier effect, as economists sometimes like to say. So that's part of what's worrying Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, the other economists in the Obama team. They keep thinking we're going to put $800 billion in, but of that, how much is actually going to get spent quickly in a way that will revive the economy? And it's less than they'd like.
Margaret, behind this very dire language this week, and it just came day after day from Obama, do you sense anything else from Congress? Are they as worried and as dire terms up there as the president-elect is at the podium and everywhere else he shows up?
About the economy,
yes,
and the future of the country? Yes, I absolutely think so. I mean, I think that especially House members or Senate members facing reelection in 2 years have a tendency to be, you know, more short-sighted or self-interestedly political often when it comes to a time of crisis. But I think in this situation, anyone who's paying attention, and I think most members of Congress are, they understand this is a really big deal. Not only do they not want it on their watch if we descend closer to a depression, but nobody wants it to happen.
Well, it's happening right now. Barack Obama talking about it all week long in very big terms, and the stimulus package coming down the pike. We're looking at a week in the news from Gaza to Capitol Hill. David Ignatius is with us from the Washington Post. Margaret Tolliff just taking up as White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Jack Beatty is here. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. First week of 2009, full week. A lot to look at here. Barack Obama talking this morning about his intelligence picks and much more on Capitol Hill. But David Ignatius, take us to Gaza 2 weeks now into the Israeli attacks, trying to root out that rocket fire and maybe Hamas itself. How do you see Israel's goals evolving as this long and increasingly bloody foray continues?
To me, the Gaza episode has illustrated, again, the essentials of the impasse in the Middle East. The Israelis faced a real security problem in the rockets that were being fired from Gaza. Hamas had agreed to a ceasefire that expired December 19 and refused to renew it. The rockets began to launch again into Israel, and the Israelis decided to take very decisive action. The problem is, once you begin these things, and this is what we saw in Lebanon in 2006, what I saw in Beirut in 1982, long ago when I was a correspondent there, once you start these things, how do you stop them? What are the terms under which you end them? And the Israelis are seeing in this instance, as in the past, that a decisive resolution to this kind of fight is almost impossible because of international opinion, because of the danger of civilian casualties, a whole series of reasons. So you end up looking for, at the end of the day, a ceasefire, and that's where we are now. And then the dickering is over when the ceasefire should come, and can the Israelis get inclusion of some tough measures to reduce the flow of weapons into Gaza.
But Israel went in here saying, clearly indicating that its goal was more than, you know, some churning around and then a ceasefire. I mean, you know,
yes,
it said that, Tom.
But I think the point I want to make is that kind of decisive resolution that people talk about is not realistically possible. The Israeli Interior Minister Meir Shatrit, in the first days of this, said something that I found haunting. He said, "We're going to continue this until we break the will of the Palestinians to continue to target us." If there's one thing that we've learned in this conflict, it's that breaking the will of the other side just doesn't work. People keep talking in those terms, but it doesn't happen. So you end up having to settle for halfway things that patch together a new version of the status quo ante. That doesn't make Israelis happy. It certainly, the fighting has not made Palestinians happy. I think for Obama, the events of the last 2 weeks show that a decisive new American approach to these things, and talking about a new approach to the Middle East sounds like a hopeless task, but somehow breaking out of the lanes in which everybody's stuck is crucial. I know they're talking about it and thinking about it. Whether they can do something different, we'll see.
I want to ask you, Margaret, what that might be. Let's listen to President Bush for just a minute here. On Monday, he talked to reporters at the White House. He had a photo op with the Vice President of Sudan. President Bush, who has been pretty much green lights for Israel in his time in office, underlining here his support for Israel in the Gaza conflict.
Hamas decided to use Gaza to launch rockets to kill innocent Israelis. And Israel's obviously decided to protect herself and her people.
And then here's Barack Obama, news conference Wednesday, defending his lack of public involvement comment so far on the conflict in Gaza, saying he can't take the lead until his inauguration.
The silence is not as a consequence of a lack of concern. In fact, it's not silence. It is, I've explained very clearly exactly what institutional constraints I'm under.
Yes, but kind of silence on what he might do or do differently. Margaret Tolliver, what's being anticipated in the Obama crowd? You're covering the White House now and will as he comes in. David Ignatius says time for a new way here. Get outside the lines. Has the Obama camp spotted what that might mean?
We don't know. I think, yes, he's looking for a new way. But here's what he's up against. When he did his Middle East and Europe trip over the summer, he visited Sderot, the town where
rockets have fallen. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Mm-hmm. And to that extent, he's sort of been there on the ground and had said, this is important to me and you're important to me. But he also very much wants to change U.S. diplomacy with the rest of the world, with our allies in Europe. And most other nations around the world feel sympathetic toward Palestinians in this case. They feel that Israel's response, even if Hamas started it, is overkill. So it is very complicated to decide where to get involved and how to get involved. And you pull one way and it pushes the other.
Jack Beatty, it's a tough one here on this front, but do you see room for a new American path through this endless and this week just agonizingly bloody situation?
Well, I think the Palestinian people will find a new path. People have been talking about a two-state solution for a long time. Really now we see there are three states, the Hamas state, the West Bank state, and Israel. But Nuri Nusayib, the Palestinian intellectual, wrote earlier this year that we've got nowhere, the Palestinians really have, with the two-state solution. It's not coming, he didn't think, and that that we're going to have an election in Israel next month. Benjamin Netanyahu, who's an opponent of the peace process, is favored. Nusayib was saying is eventually Palestinians are going to conclude we have to have a one-state solution, a binational state. And he said the way to get it is through massive civil disobedience modeled on the American civil rights era.
What, one state meaning?
Meaning the West Bank.
Forget Israel's borders. Forget the West Bank and Gaza borders. It's all one. That's anathema, to Israel. But
essentially force the Israelis to choose. Will you be a democracy or will you be a Jewish state? You can't be both. And, with an African-American president in the White House, this sort of campaign, you can imagine gaining traction. Now, there's a lot to it. It'll be motivated by despair, and I'm sure it'll be violent. But I think that's what the future may well hold. More and more people talking about a one-state solution.
Wow. Let's go to our listeners, Springfield, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for putting me on. The only thing that I'm concerned about is that I believe that Israel is inspired to cease fire. And also the two-state solution. But the problem is that these Arabs are really not really going to be friendly to Israel, even if Israel gives them West Bank to Gaza. So is the international community putting together a mechanism that even if West Bank and Gaza become independent, will they be able to secure the borders of Israel without any incursion from the Hamas or Fatah or whoever will be in charge, or even arming themselves to the teeth that they want to claim back the prior pre-1948 47 borders.
Right. International troops up and down those borders. It's a lot to ask, and we're not even on the doorstep of a two-state solution here. You wish they could protect that. Jack's wondering if Palestinian sentiment is going to blow right by that to one state. Of course, Israel pushing back. Let's go to Paul in White River Junction, Vermont. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I am very saddened by the Israeli response in Gaza, and even though I understand the issue of rockets fired from Gaza, I think we have to go back to the very beginning when the Middle East situation was imposed by the United Nations. And now I think the United Nations, all the countries of the world, have to impose a new solution. And that would be, in my way of thinking, one, the rights of the Palestinian refugees who were originally kicked out of Israel or left Israel. They need to be dealt with, and they need to be resettled. They are living in concentration camps.
Resettled where, Paul? Resettled where?
Okay. Secondly, I think maybe your gentleman who said a one-state solution is the only thing. Yes, I think that's something we as Americans have to consider now. I think that the Israelis have lost their right at this point by their overreaction in Lebanon and Gaza to have a state of their own, maybe, but they definitely have to yield and make concessions, and the United States needs to change its policy toward Israel.
That's a lot to hand down to Israel. Not high odds of them going for it. But Paul, thanks for your call. David Ignatius, I mean, are the terms of this debate changing this radically, or is this is this pie in the sky? Is this some kind of reality, whether or not Israel wants to hear this? The demographics are certainly inexorably changing.
Well, there's some signs of change in public opinion in the U.S. and slight change from traditional levels of support from Israel. But the idea that Israel is going to agree to commit suicide is just crazy. I mean, that's not going to happen.
And one state means that. It means the erasure.
Which would have a demographic majority of Arabs would mean the end of the Jewish state of Israel, and Israel's not going to agree to that. It's precisely that understanding that led Ehud Olmert to decide in principle that he wanted to move toward peace, to work with the Bush administration. That effort wasn't strenuous enough. It didn't produce results. But I think that I would guess that a majority of Israelis understand this demographic requirement that they move toward peace, that the two-state solution is in their best security interests. That's why some new aggressive, creative effort by the Obama administration is crucial. Let me just note one thing that's in a sense on the periphery, but I think really isn't. Before Christmas, I was in Damascus, and I interviewed Syrian President Bashar Assad. Assad told me, as he's told many others, that he is ready to move to direct negotiations with Israel and a resolution of Syria's outstanding disagreements with Israel in a peace treaty if the Israelis make clear that they're willing to return the Golan Heights, etc. This Syrian track has a lot of promise. Israelis themselves are really quite encouraged by it. It's been mediated so far by Turkey. But that's one thing that's just teed up for the Obama administration, is to move toward a more direct American support for this. Assad said correctly that it's crucial that as the negotiations with Syria are happening, there also be negotiations on the Palestinian issue. He's not trying to do it alone. He's not embarrassed to go first, if that's the way it works. He also proposed negotiations with Lebanon, which in effect, because Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government, means a kind of indirect negotiation with Hezbollah. So that range of discussions and possibilities, I think, is actually quite rich. I'm not saying it's going to work. I'm not saying anything's going to happen quickly. But I think it's a path that you can see ahead for Obama that leads somewhere.
Let me get one more call on this front. Danny in Belmont, Massachusetts. Danny, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Actually, I'm sorry. My name is Nitai. Got mispronounced. But I just want to comment about the whole situation with the Hamas and the Palestinian people in general. Israel is basically one of the most democratic and open-minded countries I know. We actually have in the parliament, in the Knesset, Palestinian Arabs like Dr. Ahmed Tibi. We also had another one, Azmi Bshara, which during the second war with Lebanon a couple of years ago, actually went and gave information to Syria and the Hezbollah, and now is basically AWOL, is in Syria hiding.
And Itai, let me ask you, when this one-state solution comes up, as it does these days, as an Israeli, I guess you're Israeli, how do you respond to that? Is that totally off the boards? Do you see that as propaganda? Do you see it? Do you still have hope for two-state solution?
I think that everybody in Israel wants that. The problem is how you collaborate security for the state of Israel and a two-state solution. It's very difficult. You know, if you go back to for example the war in Iraq or 2,000 years of history, you cannot change in a heartbeat. To create democracy, to create a reasonable thought within those people, you have to change everything. You have to change the education, which is now based in mosques, and they teach little kids how to kill Israelis, kill Americans, kill basically the Western world. And the only thing that Israel is trying now to do is pretty much disengage, disconnect, be its own country. But it's impossible because of our geographic position.
And that's a pretty big fact, and it's pretty deeply engaged right now, right there in Gaza. And Itai, thank you very much for your perspective. Margaret, tell if a lot of this is going to come back around to Capitol Hill. The makeup of the Senate has been a big question this week. Let's listen for a moment. On Monday, Al Franken spoke to reporters after the Minnesota Canvassing Board certified his Senate victory.
This was a hard-fought victory, and that I didn't win the support of every Minnesotan. I'm going to have to earn it by being a senator who fights for every Minnesotan, whether you voted for me or not.
Margaret Tolliff, help us here with the Norm Coleman-Al Franken contest. Norm Coleman contesting now, I guess, in court, and then we come to Burris. But Franken-Coleman first, is this over? Is this still really up in the air?
Well, it's up in the air until a court says it's not up in the air. I think probably the overwhelming expectation is that Franken, well, I don't know, I don't want to say overwhelming. I think there's probably a majority expectation that Franken will take that seat, but it is not done until a court decides, and Coleman is showing that he and Republicans are behind him are going to fight this to the end.
And what about Roland Burris and the whole Blagojevich saga? We saw early in the week what looked like a door slammed in his face and the poor guy stumbling down the Capitol steps with the press all over him. By week's end, it looks as though he's headed in. Is that how it looks to you, Margaret?
Yes, he is almost certainly headed in, and the Democratic leadership had its reasons for handling it the way it did. I think they now probably see it as a miscalculation or a calculation that could have been made better. The image of him standing out on that rainy, misty day, freezing outside of the Capitol when they probably didn't really totally have the law behind their decision was not so swift. I'm still not entirely clear on whether they just thought, well, Burris will never do this if we make a big fuss at the beginning, or if they thought that Governor Blagojevich would be indicted before it all came to a head, or if they just thought, you know what, let's go to court and roll the dice. It's so important for us not to be associated with Blagojevich that we'll, you know, take the heat. But either way, it has ended up not looking that good for the Democratic leadership at a time when they have signaled they want to hit the ground running and be a party of unity.
Of course, Blagojevich facing an impeachment vote in Illinois today. Jack, what do you make of this Burris-Blagojevich saga and how it's worked for the Democrats, for the country?
Well, I think that, you know, Harry Reid, I think, was he was premature in his blanket statement about we won't seat him and so on, given the Constitution and given the precedents and given his own record. There's no taint to him at all. He's had an exemplary record in public life. And I think that, you know, so he had to climb down. There's just no question about that. You know, what I'm struck with, I'm keeping a list of, it's called Elections Have Consequences. And right at the top of my list is some of the things that are happening now in Congress. The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act is up today. That'll pass. Children's health care, that'll be up next week. That'll pass. Lots of things are happening even now with this new Congress.
Majority has changed, and off it goes. Jack Beatty, Margaret Tolliff, David Ignatius, stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Riots in Oakland. Obama pages Dr. Gupta and lights out on Broadway this week. Angry crowds took to the streets in Oakland, California over a deadly police shooting.
We want justice for that. The police is getting away with murder. And out in the streets, they talk about they serve and protect us. They don't serve and protect us. They kill us.
CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta, TV medical man, is reportedly Barack Obama's pick for Surgeon General. Here he is on his weekend show, House Call.
Thanks, guys. This is House Call. We're making the rounds this morning of some of the most intriguing medical stories of the week. First up, would you know what to do if you were having a stroke?
And bad news for Broadway and the New York economy. At least 16 shows will close by the end of February as audiences get walloped by recession. One of the casualties, hairspray.
What gives a girl power and punch? Is it charm? Is it boys? No, it's hairspray. What gets a gal asked out to lunch? Is it brains? Is it dough? No, it's hairspray.
We're looking at a week in the news with Margaret Tollib from McClatchy Newspapers, David Ignatius from The Washington Post, and Jack Beatty. David Ignatius, intelligence is right in the middle of your bag, as we once said. I want to ask you about Leon Panetta. Here's Barack Obama on Tuesday telling reporters he was looking what he was looking for in intelligence leadership.
We are putting together a top-notch intelligence team that is not only going to assure that I get the best possible intelligence unvarnished, that the intelligence community is no longer geared towards telling the president what they think the president wants to hear, but instead are going to be delivering the information that the president needs to make critical decisions to keep the American people safe.
And so Leon Panetta, once a congressman, White House chief of staff, not an intelligence guy, but headed off to be head of the CIA. How do you read it, David? What does it mean?
Well, the Panetta pick struck a lot of people initially as an odd one because he has no background in intelligence and we had a former congressman, Porter Goss, who was pretty much a disaster as CIA director during the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. As I looked at this and talked to people, I ended up thinking that it was probably a smart choice for the following reason. The CIA suffers from a lack of political support. It's that rare agency that gets beat up from the left and the right pretty much equally. It's close to having no real constituency of support in Washington, and that's worrisome for a country that needs a strong intelligence service in an era of terrorism. So the argument for Panetta is he's a genuine Washington heavyweight. He's a guy who's got friends on both sides of the aisle, who's been around Washington a long time, who's a very good chief of staff to President Clinton by most accounts, who could stand up to Clinton and discipline him. And he's the kind of advocate that the agency arguably needs right now. A lot of people, including me, would like to see a professional, a career CIA officer, serve in the future as director to kind of depoliticize the agency. But for now, none of the professionals really are strong enough to be able to carve out space and support for the agency, I don't think. So I think the argument for Panetta is an interesting one. I'm told that Obama himself, characteristically, in his law professor's way, has been reading into this subject. He's getting briefed every day about intelligence. He's asking questions. Well, what if we didn't have rendition? What would we do? Well, what about the way we interrogate people? How should that be done? In other words, he's getting his mind around all the issues, and I think that means he's going to be more personally engaged than you might have thought because he has absolutely no background in this. Final point is that we have this Intelligence Reorganization Act that was enacted in 2004. Mike McConnell has been the so-called director of national intelligence, a new bureaucratic position. By most accounts, it's kind of a mess. It's layering of bureaucracy.
But technically, the boss of the CIA chief.
He is technically the boss of the CIA chief, but it's a very uneasy, unstable relationship. And the new DNI, so-called, retired Admiral Dennis Blair, is going to go there pretty much, as I understand it, with a mandate to streamline that operation. There's a recognition this is a big, lumpy, undigested reorganization. Let's streamline it. Let's reduce the number of personnel in the DNI structure. So that's a good thing, too.
Margaret Tollef, how are you hearing this read in Washington? Leon Panetta, on the record, is very strongly against torture, and he's not out of the intelligence community. Could this be a sign, or is there fear inside the CIA that there's a house cleaning coming with this?
Yeah, yes. And I think, you know, one thing that President-elect Obama wants to do is a PR rehab of the CIA, both to the general public and to Capitol Hill. And I think Panetta, because he's an outsider, does send that signal that he doesn't have these built-in relationships with these people. He knows budgets and a lot of times operations and policies and weird things that aren't publicly disclosed, or you can find them in budgets, and he'll know how to find that stuff, and he has Obama's confidence, and he doesn't need the job, and he doesn't care how long he stays in Washington. So for all of those reasons, yes, I think that there is a lot of somewhere between curiosity and fear, depending on who it is, about why Obama picked him, what Panetta is going there to find out, what he's going to do. But I also think that much of the initial resistance on Capitol Hill, particularly from the outgoing and incoming intelligence chairs, was that they weren't consulted first. And when you're going to be the chairman of a committee, you know, you don't want to be blindsided by something like this. And Dianne Feinstein initially indicated that Panetta would not have been her choice, and a couple of days later came around and said, well, you know, Obama and I have talked and I get it more now, and that she indicated she intends to support him. So I think a lot of the initial resistance on the Hill, at least, has subsided, if not completely evaporated.
We'll see. Let's go to Galesburg, Illinois on this. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm all for Panetta's selection, mainly because he's not part of the group, and on the inside, I think that's a good thing for a lot of reasons. The other thing you mentioned, would you like to be president now? Hmm. Oh, probably not, but it'd be nice to be president 1 year and get Iraq to pay for pay us back with their oil money, and maybe cut down the farm subsidies, things like that, that I'd like to see. But Panetta's a good idea because he's not on the inside. Thanks.
Dennis, in Galesburg, Illinois, thanks very much. Jack, how do you see it? Do you see the thin edge of the wedge here, a little bit of glint of sword here, putting Panetta in there? There's been talk about legal action over what happened with interrogation and torture and maybe even rendition.
Yeah, I think the CIA has severely hurt the United States, our image in the world in the Bush years, and not just Bush administration, but the CIA itself. You know, it still reserves the right to torture. There is rendition. We know the whole story. Someone has got to reform that, because any good the CIA is doing for us via spying or things like this action in Pakistan the other day, assassinating these leaders, any good is way offset by the bad of rendition and torture and the rest. And I like the fact that Obama did not consult with Jay Rockefeller and Dianne Feinstein. These two were deeply implicated in enabling the Bush administration on intelligence. They voted for the FISA Immunity Act. They were on the insiders who knew about these things going on, and partly because of the strange limitations on oversight of intelligence, couldn't say anything, and in effect rubber stamped some of the policies that have got us into trouble. So I hope that was deliberate. I hope he sent them a signal saying, look, you've got to clean up your act too. Your job is to show oversight, not just rubber stamp these things.
Maybe even a little hip check shot across the bow with Congress there. But David Ignatius, it is fascinating. John Brennan, who many thought might be in line for the top job at the CIA, out because of his associations with some of the policies during the Bush years, but now in as he's got another very high role here. You'll know it better than I.
He's going to be, it appears, a kind of deputy national security advisor with overall responsibility for counterterror and homeland security.
So is this an example of Obama, down in the mechanism, he's got a guy who knows the machinery. Out front, he's got Panetta, who's the sort of clean break face.
Brennan's supporters say that he was unfairly attacked as if he'd been a proponent of waterboarding and other harsh interrogation techniques when he wasn't. I don't know the details of that. Certainly, when he was pushed back by liberal critics, criticized very sharply, the fact that he's getting this key job is a sign from Obama that past experience in the intelligence community, even if you were there at the time when they were doing things that we now regard as questionable or wrong, is not a disqualification. I should just want to note in response to something that Jack said. I think it's a mistake for people to see the CIA as an independent advocate of of waterboarding, of things we regard as torture, of things we would say are wrong. The agency was very, very uncomfortable with being asked to do this initially after 9/11. They asked for authority in writing. They said, you know, well, you may want to do it, President Bush or Vice President Cheney, but, you know, opinions may change. Congress is clamoring for action. They say, are you doing enough? I mean, back then in late 01, 02, the question was, are you doing enough? That's what they were hearing from Congress, not that you're doing too much. So they would give it to us in writing, get us legal opinions, and this was protracted. They do what they're told, as they should, that they're not there to defy orders from the executive branch. So if we're angry about what happened at the concert, the way in which the United States' reputation in the world was tarnished, the address for blame on that, I think, is the White House, the Bush administration. And it's a mistake to see the CIA as an independent actor making this happen on its own. It didn't.
Let's look at another piece this week. Bill Richardson, New Mexico governor, withdrawing as Obama's nominee for Commerce Secretary and saying that there was a probe into lobbyists who later got business with New Mexico. Margaret Tolove, is this a shocker? Is this now, is this new territory that's out of bounds in Washington? How was Richardson's step back received? And was he pushed by the Obama camp?
It wasn't a shocker so much as this sort of protracted weird thing where everybody thought, well, the probe must not be that bad if Obama's going to name him and then keep him there and not withdraw him. And the Republicans in the Senate were saying, well, we'd have to know more based on what we know now. He's likely to go through confirmation. And the Democrats were preparing for the hearings. And then all of a sudden over the weekend, he was gone. And so it was, I think, a surprise, but not a shocker. And yes, I do think that once the Obama transition team understood that this probe was more serious and came closer to Richardson himself than they initially thought, that coupled with the Blagojevich scandal and, you know, there's just a general desire for Obama to be able to take office without criticism of him being anywhere close to corruption, and this was a real problem, and Richardson knew he had to go, and so did Obama, and so he went.
Jack, is this a tightening up of the lines here? Are we getting clearer boundaries with a new administration coming in? How do you read what happened?
Well, I hope we do. I mean, in investor-driven politics, that defines our recent American history. This week, the day that Richardson stepped down, the New York Times on its front page had a story about pay-to-play in New York State. A Syracuse developer wanted tax favors. He made a $100,000 contribution to Bill Clinton's one of his foundations, and lo and behold, Hillary Clinton had a legislation passed that benefited that man and four other people in the entire United States. Same week we have the, you know, pay-to-play in Illinois. We have the case of Charlie Rangel, pay-to-play in Manhattan, with all kinds of ethical improprieties piling up on him. We have news this week, the Hispanic caucus, members of it, received much backing from mortgage companies to, you know, push those mortgages out the door to people who perhaps couldn't afford them, and it became very lucrative for the congressman. You know, just because, you know, we look at Blago, we say, oh my God, that guy wants money in his pocket. Mm. That's bad. But what's much worse is the systemic corruption, where money rules politics, where contributions to campaigns rule and foundations and the like rule determine votes. That's far worse than just some congressman getting some governor getting some money in his pocket. And yet strangely, the Obama victory, which he really has taken the momentum out of campaign finance reform drive, because it's, you know, he said, even I think very sophistically during the campaign, I'm virtually public finance because I'm getting small donations from from so many people. Well, as we know, about 40% of those donations were bundled. They weren't from small contributors. And so, but I'm just terribly afraid that, you know, that the old ways are going to come back and that the Democratic Party is going to have a lot of trouble with corruption in the years ahead.
Well, of course, there were a lot of small contributors in there as well, and they're still feeling their piece of the action. I think we got Pam from Norfolk, Massachusetts. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling really to comment on Obama's, you know, selection for the administration and then speech this week. Myself and some of the other moms that I know in my area really feel like he's doing the right thing in terms of his administration. He's picking the right people. He's trying to make sure that he surrounds himself with people that will keep him informed. He wants to know all aspects of an issue, not just those aspects that support his position. And with his speech this week, we all kind of felt pulled in by him. I mean, he is trying to make sure that we as Americans feel informed and know what's going on. And frankly, I haven't felt that in a very long time from the administration.
Yeah, it's been a long time for a lot of people. Obama, clearly a big communicator. And then, of course, that tableau of him standing there, Margaret, with four former presidents plus one soon to be. You hear Pam's thought on this new president. You saw that tableau like everybody else this week. Do you see a new kind of president in the making here when you put him up against the four who stood alongside in the Oval Office, Margaret?
Well, I think he could be a new kind of president and that he wants to be a new kind of president, but look at his first week in Washington. He goes Hawaii to Chicago to D.C. His girls start school. He's got a stimulus package. Richardson's out. Panetta's in. What in the heck is going on with Caroline Kennedy? There's Roland Burris. There's the first strains with the Congress. I think there's a lot of possibility there, and a lot of people want it to happen, but wanting it to happen and making it happen are two different things.
A president's going to be busy. There's no question about that. David Ignatius, do you see a changing of the guard in that tableau in the Oval Office, or continuity because of the kind of pressures and you know, million decisions a minute that every president faces?
Well, the two things that are striking to me. One is obviously the fact that we have an African-American president, a stunning new moment in American history. Second is that Obama is really trying to govern from the center. He's moved toward the center, you could argue toward the right. It's almost a government of national unity. He's got prominent Republicans in it. So,
and with that, we're out for today. David Ignatius, Washington Post, Margaret Taleb, Jack Beatty, thanks to you all. From the center, we hear. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.